Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
This is the Directors Guild Theater, and there's no better director around than David Cronenberg, and here he is.
Yes, I've been watching Vigo too much. I thought I could actually do what he does.
It's better if you're naked.
You mean I'm not? This is just tattoos.
Okay. Well, when we last saw you, this museum audience saw you right when History of Violence was coming out, and that film was a big success both commercially and critically. And I just want to ask you, as a way of a segue into this film, what, how it came about that this was your next project, and sort of what was opened up to you after that film?
Well, people sometimes get the impression that you can kind of pick and choose what movies you do, and you're thinking of the arc of your career, and now the musical comedy, you know. And in fact, maybe I even would do that, but in fact it has more to do with what comes along, whether it comes from you or an adaptation or you see a newspaper or article or your agent sends you a script. And then when you find something that you're interested in, as I was with Steve's script, even then it took about a year before it came back to me because money, deals, timing, all kinds of things were not working out. And it's quite possible that I would have done another movie. There were several things that came by, and I might well have been doing, talking to you now about some other movie, that musical comedy, for example, instead of this one. So when people say, well, this is kind of a match pair with History of Violence, I can see the connections, but I had nothing to do with it in terms of willing it to happen that way. It's not as though I said, I must do a matched movie to History of Violence that's the flip side or something, or on the other side of the Atlantic, but also a gangster movie. You know, that's the way it works.
But it'll make a nice double feature at the drive-in.
It totally would. It really, really would, if there were drive-ins.
And how did you come up to write the script? I mean, it has some similarities, of course, with Dirty Pretty Things, and it's portrait of London and a side of London that we don't see often.
I think it's not just London. It's most big cities, New York, Toronto, any of those cities has the same industry is happening. The same problem is going on, which is the trafficking of human beings. And I think if you live in a city like London, I think it's not only your duty to tell those stories. It's also why wouldn't you? Because that's where the real meat, the real drama is really happening, you know. So it was just the fact that this was obviously going on, that in suburbs of London there are people who are living in slavery now, and that if that's your starting point, then you know that you've got real drama there. So that was the reason.
Okay, and then and so what was it that, was there anything in particular that drew you to this script that made you want to do it?
Me?
Yes.
You're asking me?
Yeah.
Steve paid me a lot of money under the table, and I'm very susceptible to bribery. Likewise, Vigo, he can't get work, you know. So I. No, Toronto prides itself on being a multicultural city, and so does London. And that intrigued me because it's in opposition to sort of the American theory of the melting pot, where you come to America and you become an American, you give up a lot of your national original identity. In London and Toronto, there's a theory that you can somehow come together and maintain that your culture. And there are good and bad sides to both of those concepts, really. So what you've got in London and in Steve's script is this kind of mini criminal globalization going on. And you couple that with the rise of a very raw, primitive form of capitalism coming out of Eastern Europe now that the communism has fallen. you know, the combination is very volatile, very interesting. All of these cultures, you know, we have Chechens, Azerbaijanis, Turks, and Russians, and so on. But trying to work together, but at the same time, they have these thousand-year-old enmities and hostilities, and so they never trust each other. So it's a really rich texture, and of course, Steve's dialogue and characters were wonderful.
And wasn't the poisoning of the spy, former spy, going on by Putin, ostensibly, going on at that time when you were...
Our production did that.
Okay.
Because when we started, the Russian mob in London was a very obscure topic, and we thought there should be some way of... No, but in fact, that started to happen halfway through our shoot, and literally half a block from my front door... where I was renting an apartment in London, and Vigo's and Vincent Cassel as well, there was a building owned by the Russian oligarch Berezovsky, who has a big feud with President Putin. And we walked by there every day. And suddenly there were cops in hazmat suits and forensic vans finding traces of polonium radiation there because Litvinenko had been there. So it was... We were very hot. We were radioactively hot, in fact.
Could you talk a bit about the process of the collaboration, or how the script developed? What was, say, added to it or changed? Mm.
Well, the great thing about working with David is that he has a hawk eye for things that won't work, and also an instinct for what would work. So, when we first sat down to discuss the script, there were elements of it that David instinctively knew would slow things down or it wouldn't work. So it was great to... And as a result of David's sure-handedness, the meetings didn't have to be long. It was sort of like, let's do that, so then I would go away and do it. But also, David gives you the room to fix the problem as well, you know what I mean? So it's really... It's an ideal situation.
Yeah, I found the same. I mean, you can often have writers who are very protective of their material because it's theirs, and no other reason, not necessarily because it works, and you get a whole ego thing going on there. It can be quite messy. But Steve was not like that. In fact, he was very excited to develop the script because it hadn't really gotten very far developed. It sort of had languished at BBC Films for quite some time. In fact, I think you wrote Dirty Pretty Things before it, or...?
It was sort of consecutive. This came along. I started to write this just about when Dirty Pretty Things was being taken into production.
Yeah. So that movie got made, you know, a couple of years ago, and this script just was lying around. So it never got, you know, he never got a chance to get his hands on it and really start to work with it as though it was going to get made. Because once the production is there and you're saying, okay, we're making this movie, then things get intense and they get real.
Could you talk a bit about, either of you talk about the opening scenes are so concise and strong that you go from these, because you have, there's not actually a great number of violent scenes, so they make an impression, and you have this very violent opening, and then this theme of birth is introduced, but birth itself is violent in the next scene. So.
I mean, in writing the opening scene, what I wanted to do was to take a very conventional gangster scenario, which is an execution in the barbershop, and then... having established that, then everything else should be not what you're expecting. So, you know, to go straight to birth, and the idea is of birth and death and renewal, and it's Christmas and all of that. I mean, I think those themes are there if people want to look for them. You know.
The image of that baby in that second scene is so striking. What was that?
Well, that's a fake
special
baby.
Effects.
That's a silicone baby. Yeah. I had one lying around, so I thought, you know, everybody does, don't they? At one point we thought we would actually show the birth, and I think that was in the script, and we tried that a bit, and then I really thought we didn't need to do that. I thought, and the baby, it was a special effects baby, and then added to that is a little bit of CG, a little computer work that just the lips moving and the eyes moving in a way that was subtle, too subtle to do mechanically, although the breathing was, in fact, mechanical. But it's not just the baby, it's the lighting and the angle of the shot and the makeup on the baby that makes it work so well.
Another thing that's very striking, and this is on a second viewing of the film, is the tone. You talked about having things that you don't expect, and there are more scenes of tenderness in this film than maybe struck me on the first viewing. Example, the scene with the prostitutes after a very brutal scene. There's a very tender scene, and I just wonder if you could, maybe if either of you could talk about
it. Well, I tried to get rid of all that. But I didn't manage to expunge every moment of tenderness. I tried. My analysis of Steve, as he's sitting here so I can... I think he falls in love with his characters and he has great affection for them, which is one of the great things about the script. And that goes for even the nasty characters. And then it's just a question of not going too far with that. You know, you want to make sure that you don't go over into sentimentality, but you, at the same time, want to express this affection that you have for even very flawed human beings because they are human beings.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's the fact that there are several characters who sort of deliberately and expressly and innately do not show emotion, so that when they do show some emotion, I think it has a greater effect. And I think in particular Kirill, who, I mean, I am sort of fond of that character because he's so out of control, and I think you don't forgive him for what he does, but part of you understands what he does and why he does it.
Mm-hmm. Just before opening it up to the audience, I'll ask about the scene that's already become legendary in a way, which I guess was just a line or two in the script, the fight scene in the sauna. So could you talk, I guess if both of you could talk, what you had in mind in writing it, what you had envisioned, and then how that...
I mean, I think it's a masterpiece. I think it's fantastic. And you're quite right. I mean, basically, the idea in the script is that here is someone who is naked and therefore vulnerable, who proves to us that the thing that this character is really best at and really well equipped for is this sort of violence. So that, but then, you know, the execution of it is just amazing.
I mean, in this original script, he never talked about the towel, you know? Where did it go? Was it on the guy or was it not? I mean, so we had to figure that out, Vigo and I.
You have the worst continuity person.
Really? Yeah. No, it was not too detailed, the script, and in fact, we did change a few things, I think. I think in the original script, Steve, once again, that tenderness that I so hate. Actually, the Chechens were not killed, you recall. You didn't have them dead, and I said, they've got to be dead because they're not going to stop coming after them, so you can't just punch them and make them unconscious. They've got to be dead. And there were a few other things like that, but mostly it was had to be worked out in great detail. Really, when you write a script, it is broad strokes mostly, because to put in all the detail that it takes to actually make a movie would take an 800-page script. You know, a script is not even a blueprint, because you can build a house from a blueprint, but you can't build a movie from a script in the same sense. So Steve, wily old character that he is, knows that there's going to be a crew of 150 people, very enthusiastic, doing research. You know, what kind of shoes does this gangster wear? What socks? What car does he drive? What kind of sunglasses, and where will the tattoos all be, you know, and what will they represent? None of that, you know, it would just be too laborious to read, but when you're making the movie, you have to figure all that stuff, figure all of that out.
And I gather Vigo was quite into researching this question about tattoos, which was so important.
Yeah, Vigo is an amazing collaborator. With him, I like to say, you don't just get a solo violin, you get a whole orchestra. He does his own research. He does it in the sweetest, most gentle way, because it's really for him, but he shares it. And if you don't want to look at it, he doesn't mind. And he sent me at a certain point a book called Russian Criminal Tattoo, which was phenomenal. I mean, it was an amazing book. And also a documentary made by a friend of his named Alex Lambert called The Mark of Cain, which was shot in maximum security Russian prisons, where you have 35 prisoners in a cell made for four. They literally cannot all sit down at the same time, so they have to take turns sitting down. And they all talked about their tattoos and this this subculture of tattooing in Russian prison that goes back to our Tsarist days, predates the Soviet Union by a long way, and has evolved as a kind of secret society and still exists now, although it's becoming a bit passé once again in the face of the new capitalism happening. And I sent this to Steve because I said, this is mind-boggling. You know, he had, of course, alluded to tattoos, but not ever gotten into the detail that we ended up with. And I said, no writer can resist this kind of stuff. It's just too rich. You know, we're going to, when we do another rewrite, you're going to want to incorporate this into the film in a huge way.
Just one other detail while it's on my mind. We're talking about physical details. Anna's character, the fact that she rides motorcycle seems to be a really important detail. It says something about her character being kind of an... and I know you were very interested in motorcycles. Mm.
What I wanted was that the presence or non-presence of her father had recently died. The motorbike belonged to him, so it's also a Russian motorbike. So we visually, even if we forget that detail, visually there is some connection between her and her father there, so that when she meets Semyon, we understand that she's sort of looking for that sort of father figure.
Okay, let's open it up. Raise your hand, and I'll repeat questions just so we can everybody can hear. Okay, over here. This sounds like an unusually high amount of collaboration with the scriptwriter after the script is written and while you're in production.
That's pretty normal, I think, and normal for me. Certainly I did even more of that on History of Violence. Truthfully, it would be great to have a script arrive that was so perfect you didn't want to touch one thing in it and just go make it. It's very rare, though, that that happens. And part of the reason is that there is a tendency now, and I think it's been there for a long time, that producers or studios don't really want to get into paying for the second draft until they have a director on board, because directors have a habit of rambunctiously changing everything and not liking stuff. And it's not worth doing a draft to a producer's specification, because basically the producers don't really... They actually often don't know how to read a script really well. You know, they don't really understand what it needs to make it work on screen. They just have an instinct that it could be good. So I think that's the reason. It's not really that unusual that a director should get very involved in the rewriting of a screenplay. And that takes nothing away from what the screenwriter is doing. The more that the screenwriter can do, the happier that I am, because I'm very, very lazy.
And are you thinking of who's going to be directing this when you're writing it? And was he in the top
no, I mean,
10 of your list?
I mean, truthfully...
He wasn't thinking of me at all. Guarantee you.
I mean, truthfully, you write the script because you write it on behalf of your characters, I think. And, you know, it's great news when someone comes along who's going to... Because when there's a director's on board, that's when you know that you're probably going to go into production quite soon.
Yeah. Okay. Over here. Yeah, go ahead. Were there many deleted scenes? Were there many scenes that you guys filmed that didn't make it in?
No. There were a couple. There were some. One of the things that Steve will tell you is that I love short scripts, and that most of my glee and pleasure comes from cutting, which you might imagine. I think of that scene where he's cutting off the fingers, and I say, yeah, the guy will be, he'll weigh less. It's one way of losing weight.
You can still buy the DVD, don't
you? But no, you will not see these scenes on the DVD, because I don't like doing that. I did that with one scene in History of Violence. That's the first time they're deleted because I don't like them. not because... And really often not because of a performance or whatever, but just because once they don't work, they're gone, you know, they're out of my head, and I don't see why you should see them any more than you want to read the original draft of Steve's script, do you?
Yes.
And I'll tell you that the other reason is that those scenes don't get developed either. They're like the first draft, you know. Often I edited this movie in 3 weeks. So I don't I don't spend a lot of time normally if the movie's working, and I'm very concise on set. You know, I don't do storyboards, but I'm pretty precise, and so there's not a lot. I'd love to get to the point where I've cut the script so tightly that there are no deleted scenes, that we shoot everything and it's needed. I haven't quite achieved that yet, but there were a couple of scenes that they don't get mixed. You know, they don't get refined because I cut them very early in the editing process, so they're not finished. And I don't have the heart to finish them to the extent that I could present them to you on the DVD as finished scenes the way they would have been if they'd been in the movie. So that's my feeling. Did I have to go back to film? You mean reshoots kind of thing? No, I think there was... No, not really. No.
He knows what he's doing, really. Trust me. Okay, another question. Over here. Yeah. Okay, how long did the filming take, and how long did the fight scene take to film?
It was a 53-day shoot, so it was basically 10 weeks plus a little bit. The fight scene took about 2 days to shoot. Viggo, having had experience doing other fight scenes on other movies, said that normally something like that would take a week. And he was very glad that it didn't, because he was getting very bruised and beaten up. You know, there was a time when, I mean, obviously he can't wear pads, you know, he's naked. So it meant that, I mean, the effects makeup man, Stéphane Dupuis, he's a wonderful, he's brilliant, said to me, you know, David, I'm spending more time covering up Vigo's bruises than I am putting the tattoos on every day. And I said, I just don't tell me that. I don't want to know. It takes a lot of preparation, though. Though I don't do storyboards, and though I love to come on the set not knowing what I'm going to do, because I want the spontaneity of everybody to be involved. And speaking of collaboration, I want the collaboration of everybody on the set. So I have monitors everywhere. Some directors are very possessive about the image. They don't want other people to have the image and know what they're shooting. I want it open to the whole crew. I want everybody to know what's going on, including the actors. If they want to look at it, I'll play it back for them. So that's that kind of trust and transparency that's there on the set, which allows you to do a scene like that with a major actor. And the preparation that goes into it, with the designing of the set, with Carol Spear, who's a set designer I've worked with for 30 years, and the working out of the choreography with the stunt coordinator and the actors. And it's a lot of preparation. So we knew exactly what the fight scene was going to be, as far as you can know without actually shooting it. Because once you start to shoot it, everything changes, which is why I don't do storyboards. Everything changes, and I like that. It really just took 2 days.
Is there discussion about the thematic elements of the film? And as an example, it occurred to me watching that fight scene that it has something to do with the idea of birth. There's a lot about birth and rebirth in the film, and he has just talked in a previous scene about being dead, you know, being dead, and that scene is sort of a rebirth. And people have talked about how the film has elements and thematic relationship to your other work, but how does that manifest itself in terms of how you work on the set?
Steve is twitching. I think it means he wants to say something.
No, I mean, I hope that people do. It's sort of not essential that people get the themes, I don't think, to enjoy the film. But there are themes of rebirth and resurrection all the way through, I think. Yeah. And also violence as destructive and violence as creative, and you know, I think those images and those themes are there. But I do think even if you're not consciously aware of them, you feel their energy, the energy of those ideas in there, I think.
Yeah, somebody actually came up with a very interesting religious interpretation of the whole movie, with the baby being Moses and the bulrushes. Honest to God, I'm serious. And you know, it was convincing. I'm convinced. I've made a religious epic. Oh, my God. I loved Ben-Hur. The truth is that even as you cannot photograph an abstract concept and an actor cannot act
the role of an abstract concept. I, as a director, cannot direct an abstract concept. You know, and I'm talking about themes here. You can't really, that doesn't help you creatively do anything, even though when the film works, it does evoke these things and provoke them in the minds of the audience, and that makes it potent and interesting and makes for interconnections and stuff. But basically, when you're making the movie, it's really detail by detail, shot by shot. Although it's very plastic and sculptural for me, making movies. It's got a lot to do with space and three dimensions and moving through space and stuff. And at that point, no more than a sculptor can really think of the themes of what he's doing. You're working with stone or whatever it is, and you're trying to get the chisel to work, and that's how it feels.
It seems like there was a lot of emphasis on intimate exchanges between characters. Was that a conscious thing?
Well, it was written that way. It's a very intimate film, really. And also, I think the claustrophobia of, you know, what we were talking about, the multiculturalism, everybody being jammed together and having to figure out a way to work together, even if it's a criminal enterprise.
What I wanted to get in there is that there are a lot of secrets. There are a lot of people with two lives. There are a lot of moments when secrets are shared, or when we can see that secrets are not being shared in the normal way. So, yeah, I mean, that intimacy between characters who are desperately trying not to show their feelings, I think, is important, and that causes the tension, I think.
And knives are intimate.
You know, more so than
much
guns.
More intimate more than of guns. And Steve's script, there were no guns. And in London, there are a lot of guns. I mean, in England now, there used to be a time when the bobbies, famously, the police didn't carry guns, but that's long gone. But I liked that element of Steve's script because it meant forced intimacy. I mean, if you're going to kill somebody with a short, little, curvy knife, that's an intimate act. It's got a strange, perverse eroticism about it, especially if he's naked in a steam bath, of course.
But there is an underlying sexual undercurrent and a homoerotic undercurrent, which perhaps you are not working out consciously what you want to do with it, but it seems to be there throughout the film.
There is?
But we could read. I could be reading into it.
No, of course there is.
Yeah.
And that is Steve's basic repressed homosexuality coming out.
But, I'll show you my tattoo then.
Yeah, well, it starts with Kirill, the character of Kirill, you know, who is basically really in love with Nikolai and is a gangster who's gay, who could not possibly admit that even to himself, because that's like a death sentence in that milieu. So, and Nikolai, for his own reasons, and at first we think it's because maybe he just wants to use Kirill to rise in the mob, and then later we realize he has other reasons for doing it, but he flirts with him, he manipulates him, he uses that love and that sort of repressed homosexuality for his own purposes. So that's the basis of that, and then it comes out also in the steam bath scene and so on.
Anything up in the not calling it the balcony, all the way back there, up in the balcony. Okay. Have you always had this kind of open collaboration on a set, or has that evolved more over time?
Well, the first movie I did, it was called Shivers, and it was shot in 15 days, and I think the collaboration with the actors came later, because in that first movie, it was like the actors were the bulls in your china shop, you know? And the movie was the china shop, because I had such a tight schedule that if an actor said, why don't I lie down over there instead of saying the line by the window? And I go, no, we can't light over there. We got the lights are over there. And I got 10 minutes to shoot this. Then we got to kill the security guard and crash the car. And so I didn't realize, though, that you could just say that to an actor, and then he would find some way to make what you had to do interesting for him. And so it took me maybe three quarters of that movie to realize that, in fact, you didn't have to think that way about your actors and that they could be collaborators. But really, I think one of the only things that I can say to a young director as advice, because everything's changed so much since I started, is that you must invent your own version of being a director. There are no rules. All of the mythology that your teachers gives you is just mythology, and you don't have to be like von Sternberg, you know, and you don't have to be like, there's no one that you have to be like. There are many ways to be a director, and it has to come from you and your own temperament. There's no point. I would be terrible yelling at actors. I'm not good at that, you know, so I don't think that that works anyway, and the actors agree with me, but nonetheless. Well, there's a great, you know, there are some directors who buy the whole you must humiliate everybody and you must torture them and you must, you know, to get good stuff. I don't find that to be the case, and I've never had any reason to think any way differently. But, so yeah, and in short, yes, I've always had a very open and collaborative set, and once monitors came in, I immediately felt, you know, that the idea that you must not show your actors, you mustn't let your actors see themselves, because they'll freak out. You know, they won't like what they've done, and they'll want to change it, they'll want to reshoot it, and then it'll take a lot of time, and so on and so on. And I suppose if you had a really neurotic actor of a certain kind, that could happen. But I've never had that be the case. Mostly actors who don't like to see themselves while they act, they just automatically just don't look. It's very straightforward.
Was it true that you and Vigo were both each reading Dostoevsky?
Yes, doesn't that sound pretentious? But it's totally true. I thought, okay, what, you know, Russianness. Okay, we've got to get into Russianness. How do we do that? Well, Dostoevsky, he's Russian. I'll read him. And I just happened to have the latest translation of The Possessed, which in the new translation is called Demons. This is the Pavir and Vorokonsky, you know, series of, and I have a lot of those new translations. And I started to read Demons, and I thought, my God, this is sort of our movie in a way, you know, anticipating it, secret societies and revolution and crime and all that great Dostoevsky and stuff. And so I phoned Vigo and I said, Vigo, you know, you really should read this because, and don't read the old translation, don't read Constant Garner, this is really much better, much rawer and cruder and so on. He said, I just finished it. So we were totally in sync. And you know, it's not research in the sort of traditional sense, but it's just we wanted to get into the soul of Russianness, and for each for our own reasons.
Go ahead, you. Vigo, okay, he's very good in these fight scenes, and did he bring fighting experience before History of Violence, or is he...
No, I had to teach him everything. In fact, we did, for history, we did look at, I did find on the net some DVDs that teach you how to kill. And so, don't mess with me, that's all I'm saying. And, because sometimes it's a reflex, I can't help it. But we did look at those because we thought that that character would have learned to fight on the streets of Philadelphia, and that would not be military training or anything else, it would be street fighting. And that's what we base that on. Whereas for this movie, we felt that he would have some military training, probably. KGB, Spetsnaz, we don't know, Special Forces. And in fact, for each of those characters in the steam bath scene, we assigned a kind of fighting to that character because they would really have learned it from different places. And in a way, it helped them to, you know, the way you fight is also an expression of character and your background. And so it was basically very worked out choreography for a specific reason, not coming from Vigo's background, although God knows, you know. But He has that scar here, you know. But he's very athletic, and it would have been very difficult, obviously, to shoot a scene like that with an actor who couldn't really do that. Stunt coordinators who help you work out the scene love working with actors, but because they come up with unusual things, and stunt guys have a stunt guy mentality, and that's usually a very, you know, restricted range of things that they would come up with. But sometimes you have to block the scene out with stunt people and then just show the actors and just let them do whatever they can. But in this case, all three guys, I mean, the big Chechen is actually a Turkish Cypriot who was 47-0 in his amateur boxing career. And the other guy was a Georgian who had been in the military. So they were very able to do this on their own. But once again, it basically is choreography that's created dramatically.
But of course, what's powerful about Viggo's performance is the subtlety and what he does when he's still, when he's not fighting, the kind of little smirk he gets. And there's so much ambiguity about how you read him, and you're always trying to, as you're watching the film, trying to figure him out and read him.
Well, he did go to Russia on his own, and some people were horrified. They said, no, you can't do that. You have to have a translator, and you have to have a guide with you and stuff. But he went to Moscow and St. Petersburg, and then he went to Yekaterinburg, which is in Siberia, which is where we figured this character would come from. And he just went alone. Because if you go as a celebrity, and Viggo never does that anyway, I can tell you, but you can't really observe people. Anonymity is really important for an artist. You need to be anonymous. You need to be able to observe without being observed. If the people are looking at you, then you can't really see them. And so he was driving a car, you know, being chased by farm dogs in Siberia and all of that stuff. And it was all to see the kind of weight of 1,000 years of depression, Russian depression, to see the way they held themselves, the way they hid themselves, the way they stayed aloof. How did they do that? And how did they speak? And he saw all of that.
And could you talk about your own research within London, how you...
Yeah, the character of Semyon is based on a real person, which is one of the first things that sort of prompted me to start writing, was someone who, even though he's involved in organized crime, used to do Pushkin readings. You know, he was really quite intellectual, but also had that fantastic hospitality and warmth, but was also quite mournful and regretful, you know, and there's that lovely sort of darkness about certain Russian characters and that certain Russian temperament, which I think is a great sort of environment for this kind of, yeah, of story to develop.
The Howard Shore's credit, when it came up, got applause, and the music, as you're talking about that tone, it so much is captured in the music. I just wonder if you'd say
I hate when that happens.
No, when they don't, when they're applauding other people.
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Howard is, you know, we grew up in Toronto.
Oh, you were the one hissing in the background.
Yeah. I was singing. That's the way I sing. No, Howard and I grew up together in Toronto, and he's done almost every movie that I've done. And he's just so sensitive, you know, to... analyzing the way music is usually used in movies, it's there to exaggerate or support the tone that's already in the scene, you know. So if it's a sad scene, you get really sad music. If it's an action scene, you get action music. And often that betrays an insecurity of the filmmakers, who feel it's not punchy enough, it's not giving you what should be there, so you know, wall-to-wall music, perhaps. But the kind of music that we like and that I ask for is music that adds a whole other layer of meaning and emotion that's not necessarily in the scene itself, or is only a subtle thing in the scene. And the violin, the voice of the violin was so beautiful. And there was a wonderful English-Italian woman who played that violin for us in the movie, and it's just so emotional and so wonderful. But, you know, you say, okay, it's Russian. So there's got to be balalaikas, right? Well, we do have balalaikas, but it would be so easy to be kitschy and just do a Russian pastiche. Howard managed to find the soul of Russianness without doing a kind of kitschy version of Russia. And it's so subtle what he does and so beautiful.
Yeah. Here, just time for a few more. Back there, standing. Okay, well, is 3 weeks a long time to edit, and what kind of editing equipment do you use? I guess he wants to get the same machine. and then at what point do you let the film go and let it?
Well, 3 weeks is ferociously short. It shocks all other directors, and they hate that I say that because then their producers will expect them to not do the 6 months of editing that they want to do. No, I think you normally in your contract, in a DGA contract, in fact, I think it's 14 weeks that you get. I think Marty Scorsese spent a year doing The Departed, I think. It really varies, but there are standards, you know, standard contracts and stuff. But no, 3 weeks is ferociously short. We did refine it after that, you know, when we sort of screened it for friends and things, and there were little things, but the structure, you know, the deleted scenes and the basic shape of it, I mean, let's put it this way. In 3 weeks, I said, okay, that's my director's cut. I'm willing to show it to my producers and to my Focus distributors. And so that means that I'm confident that that's pretty much the movie. And I'm open to feedback at that point. But usually directors are pretty reluctant to do that until they've, you know, they're pretty confident they've got what they need. And we added on Avid. I love electronic editing. People who say you should go back to film are insane. You know, forget it. Because with electronic editing, well, for me, it's like word processing. I couldn't wait to get rid of typewriters, even though if you saw Naked Lunch, you know I have affection for typewriters. But because it works the way your mind works, which is nonlinear. That is to say, you jump around and you can do that with electronic editing. So I would never, I mean, film editing is pretty much dead. I think Spielberg still does it, but that's, you know, that's him. And what else? Oh, when do you let it go? Well, you let it go, I don't find that very difficult. I mean, by the time you go into the sound mix, any cuts that you make mean a lot of work for a lot of people because you have 100 soundtracks, and if you make one frame change, then they have to change all 100 tracks. Of course, it's easier because they're all digital and electronic too. But it's so by the time you go into the sound mix, you should pretty much be prepared to say that's the cut.
And are you seeing cuts of the film? I mean, when do you see the film?
When David's done the...
I haven't let him see it yet, actually.
Yeah, exactly. What happens at
that's
it?
That's why you're
soon.
No, I mean, but the process of the edit is takes place, and then a version is shown. But, I mean, for me, interestingly, the first time of seeing anything is horrifying. It really is. It's just weird. And it's not... And at that point, you don't know if this is any good or not. And you just have to wait, and then you finally get to understand how it looks.
Is there anything
he never told me that. You know? He told me it was great.
Yeah.
Okay, right down here. We'll take one more after that. So you've had an interest in violence, terror, sexuality, sensuality throughout all your films, and what keeps bringing you back to that?
Well, isn't everybody? I can tell you that it. First of all, it's intuitive and instinctive, and then gradually, as you get older and you start to observe yourself, you come to some understanding, and I think it's. I can almost say it's a philosophy now. For me, the first fact of human existence is the human body. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in an afterlife. I think that if you kill someone, that's an act of absolute destruction. So there's no saying, well, but he's in heaven, it's okay with the 72 virgins, you know, and that there or that's karmic recycling, and he'll come back as a fish or something. So I take violence very seriously, because when we talk about violence, we're talking about the destruction of a human body, and therefore of a unique human being, by my way of figuring. So you read about statistics, 5,000 people die today, here and there. It's really, I take it seriously, it's very deep. I want it to have its weight that I think it deserves. And likewise, then, if you're thinking of the body, which so much of culture, religion, art, politics, tends to hide, you know, the importance of the human body is veiled by all of those things. If I unveil that, then of course sexuality is obviously a hugely important thing. And sensuality, when you talk about senses, sensuality, you're talking about the body. So to me, that's therefore, as an artist, drawn to what is most primal and potent and profound, that means those things to me. That's the way I see it.
Okay, well, we'll end on that grand philosophical note. I want to thank all of you. The film opens tomorrow, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.